star to show. Eagle soar and oil flow. You didn't decide what you chose. We will pay back what they owe. Crime depends from who you sold. We cheer for the villains though. Hustling, bustling, getting low. Motion is perpetual. We call drill to give and go. All you reap is what you sow. No, where are the controls? Mass of individuals consuming as ritual. You ain't hear them say by slow. Dudes, don't let them play us.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Thomas Frank, a former opinion columnist for The Wall Street Journal, the founding editor of The Baffler, and a monthly columnist for Harper's. He's the author of The Wrecking Crew, What's the Matter with Kansas, One Market Under God, and his most recent book just out, Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle, and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Frank.
How are you today, Ian?
Very well, thanks. And I'm so grateful that you could join us here. Does it surprise? I mean, it clearly surprises you, and it absolutely baffles me that at this moment in time, with what the Occupy movement has done to raise our collective consciousness about the dichotomy between the 99% and the 1%, doesn't it strike you as a little arrogant and hubristic on the part of the Republican establishment to put up a 1%er for president of the United States?
You mean Mitt Romney?
Mitt, right.
It is astonishing to me, and I think it's going to be tricky for a man like him to win this fall. For the idea of electing a quarter billionaire from I don't know if you call Bain Capital part of Wall Street, but it's something real close. You know, it's part of the financial industry. To put someone like that in the White House would be an extraordinary deed, but it would also really be in keeping with the sort of spirit of inversion that I talk about in Pity the Billionaire. That's everything is upside down these days, so I guess it probably shouldn't really surprise us.
Well, that's what's scary, though, the fact that it's upside down, the fact that there's so much angst and so much confusion out there could lead to his election as feckless and clumsy as he appears to be. And by the way, he is Wall Street because he is the epitome of all that's wrong with Wall Street, which is the extraction model. Wall Street's about extracting wealth, not creating wealth, and that's what distinguishes them from the robber barons who built America into the economic giant. And private equity, which he's so skillful at, is totally about extraction. They don't bring anything to the table. They find these ailing businesses and literally strip them and loot them, and whatever success of business follows. Is shackled to paying off huge bank loans and huge payments to these guys like Mitt Romney, who in turn only pay 15% tax.
All true. And I would say, what's really interesting about that is the only person out there that has really made that critique in a public way has been, of all people, Newt Gingrich. I'm even wondering if Barack Obama and the Democrats will go there. I feel like it's sort of off limits to them, making that kind of critique, something that would have once been second nature or even obvious to Democrats.
Well, what has compromised Democrats to the point where they've allowed the narrative over the outrage on Wall Street to be captured by the right-wing Tea Party, which ends up being a kind of AstroTurf operation? The left left
well,
that on the
like
table.
It's like a funhouse mirror. It's you said something really remarkable there, that this is the sort of central point of Pity the Billionaire, and I can't drive it home enough that this is the response to hard times, or this has been in the last 3 years, the main political response to the hard times that we're in has been this, this shifting further and further to the right, the growth of this right wing movement, and they're, what they, the politics that they want to put in place are, more of exactly the thing that got us to where we are in the first place, more deregulation on Wall Street, let these guys do whatever they want. And they they speak both of this kind of anger at Wall Street and this desire to cut the red tape, you know, and let banks do whatever they feel like. At the same time, these two ideas don't cancel one another out in their minds. It's very interesting.
But just in pure political terms, Thomas Frank, the thing that I don't understand, though, is that in pure political terms, now we're talking about, you know, the mechanics of politics, that what we started out talking about Mitt Romney being the poster boy for the one percenters, and what an insult that somebody like that is running at in these hard times. But then we made the qualification that he may actually get elected. And the reason he may get elected is that people are angry and confused, and you've got one in four households underwater in this country, meaning people owe more than their homes are worth, yeah. And you've got an enormous number of people who've lost their homes. That is a very fertile field to tap, and I can't understand it why the Obama administration has not made that their central campaign theme. Instead, they've come up with this pathetic $25 billion bailout that is literally a drop in the bucket. Explain that.
Well, this is what the sort of second half of Pity the Billionaire is about, or the last third, I should say, about the failure of Democrats to grasp the situation that history presented them with in 2008. And, you know, truth be told, at the beginning, it sure looked like Obama was the man for the moment. I mean, that's certainly what I thought in 2008 when he was elected, and, you know, those enormous crowds when he was sworn in Washington. You know, it was like Franklin Roosevelt or something like that. And but he really let the opportunity slip through his fingers, and it's persistently his mistakes have been, you know, all in a pattern. And what it repeatedly comes down to is bipartisanship and his sort of fascination with the idea of transcending partisanship in Washington, which is, you know, at one level, you know, profoundly naive. You know, there's a reason that we have two different political parties in America. And then at the same time, I'm sure he doesn't think it's naive. I'm sure he thinks it's very hard-nosed and pragmatic. But it hasn't been that. It's been a disaster for the nation and for him politically. And he's changing his tune now, but it may be too little too late. I saw a story in Business Week the other day about President Obama's campaign manager going to New York City and meeting with a bunch of investment bankers and essentially telling them that, promising to them that Obama would not criticize Wall Street in the on the campaign trail, that was off the table this fall. And, you know, that's astonishing. To think that, you know, in the aftermath of five years of an economic slump, that he's not going to criticize the people responsible for it. I just don't get that. I mean, but we all know why. Money. You right. know, if Mitt Romney has taught us one thing, it's that you've got to have a whole lot of money in your super PAC in order to blast the other guy. You know, like, look what he did to Newt Gingrich. And then look what Newt Gingrich did back to him. This is a game of where only money matters. And
well, do you think though that there has to be an educational process being president of the United States? And you know, historians argue that the first term is when you make all the mistakes, and the second term is where you actually get something done before you become a lame duck, which happens pretty quickly. So it's in that context, I'm absolutely astounded why he would still have this bipartisan impulse, this postpartisan impulse, because my understanding is, and I'll just run this by you for your analysis, Thomas Frank, is that given the fratricides that going on the Republican side, and the fact that Romney is being diminished as a candidate by his own gaffes and by the constant assault that he's under, he's not likely to emerge from this very strong. And it would seem to me that the best chance the Republicans have of winning would be a foreign policy disaster, which befell Jimmy Carter, for example. The White House hasn't been able to get a guarantee out of the Israelis that they won't attack sometime in the spring, which the Secretary of Defense just recently went public and said that there was a likely prospect that that would happen. It would seem to me that if you look at what happened during the Vietnam War, where Humphrey's chances of getting elected were hurt by secret meetings with Henry Kissinger and Madam Chiang Kai-shek that managed to get the South Vietnamese to walk out of the peace talks and deny Humphrey the peace dividend, if you will, and Bill Casey's, Reagan's campaign manager, working with the Ayatollahs to keep the hostages in Iran while Jimmy Carter twists in the wind. These are examples of the opposite of bipartisanship, which actually has a definition known as treason. But given that Eric Cantor and the Republicans are so close to Netanyahu, I don't think it's a huge reach to say that this could happen. And so if Obama's political survival is on the line here, surely if there's any truth to what I'm speculating here, he ought to get real.
Yeah, but that seems like some an unlikely series of events to actually worry about. I mean, of course the Israelis might attack Iran, but its implications on for the American presidential contest are pretty far down the list. I think there are all sorts of things that can happen between now and November that might. That might change the outcome of the election, and one of them is almost certainly, I think far likelier scenario is what's happening in Europe right now with Greece. And if the Europeans manage to, and every indication shows they're going this way so far, if the Europeans manage to fling themselves off the economic cliff and plunge the world back into another recession, which they might do, they did it in the 30s, and they might do it again.
Right.
That would you'd see unemployment spiking back up, and I think it really wouldn't matter who the Republican nominee is; he would win.
Well, what I was suggesting is that at the very least, in that scenario, the Iran scenario is that gasoline would be, at September, October could be up to $6-7 a gallon, and that would be a difficult thing for anybody to run on. And after all, the president threatened to veto the National Defense Authorization Act, not because of its infringement on civil liberties, but because of his concern that it would push the Iranians back, with the sanctions on their central bank to the war. And therefore raise the price of gasoline, and he wanted to have some wiggle room on that one.
Yeah.
So it's clearly something that they're thinking about.
You might be thinking about the price of gasoline. Absolutely. Yeah, that's always something to worry about. But this is something this is a subject I know a little bit about, not a whole lot. I'm not a great authority on it. And we always think that the supply of gasoline is, of course, related to, events in the Middle East, and it is. But it's also related to, these days, it's related to speculation. Speculators, the price of oil rises and falls with essentially with the unemployment rate and with how fast people perceive the economy is recovering, and this is because it's driven by speculation. And it would be an easy thing for the president to, when you start looking into this publicly, when you have hearings about about how this is happening, that's very helpful. And actually, this happened before. You remember in 2008, the price of gasoline went way, way, way up, and then all of a sudden it fell way, way, way down. This is amazing bubble.
The Republican alchemy, yes.
Yeah, it was very strange. And nobody can really explain it. I mean, there's no real obvious explanation except for the speculators, and a bunch of speculators got ruined, and suddenly all their bets were working in the other direction. This is something that you could hold hearings on, and that would have the same effect as bursting the bubble.
Well. I keep running these theories by you, Tom, and but Well, I did a forum recently at UCLA where I had two political pros who'd run. One of them had run John McCain's presidential campaign, and another one had run a whole bunch of Democratic presidential campaigns as well. And one of the things that they said that was fascinating was that in an election year, and we're going to spend record amounts this year, as we can see from thanks to Citizens United and these super PACs, that they only spend their money, the billions and billions of which, of course, all of which go to the media companies who get rich off our broken system, that most of the money goes to the swing states. They don't care about the other states. So we're only talking about maybe at the most a third of these states in the United States that they focus on. And then when it gets close to the elections within the in October, they concentrate on the undecided people who, if by October you are undecided after billions and billions have been spent haranguing you for months on end, you've got to be pretty stupid. And apparently the polls indicate that the swing voters are incredibly disengaged. They don't read. They don't care about anything much except, you know, potato chips and beer. And all of that money and effort is going into the dumbest, least engaged demographic in the country, who at the end of the day decide our political fate.
That's so pessimistic. What a bleak vision.
Well, these were pros, though. I mean, these are guys that do that work. So I had to, you know, take them seriously.
I'm not going to contradict you there. I'm just going to say that that's a very bleak way of looking at it. I'm pretty bleak. I'm a very pessimistic guy. But as far as I'll go down that road is to concentrate on the what fascinates me is the way the money translates pretty directly into votes. So, Romney spends X millions of dollars in Iowa, and it has, you know, such and such result in the form of, you know, blasting Newt Gingrich, you know, to pieces. And then Newt lines up his billionaire and comes back and goes after Romney with, you know, the criticism that we were talking about before, criticizing Bain Capital. And, then Romney does, you know, gets his billionaires going again and does the same thing back to him in Florida. It is fascinating, but it's just... at times, it just seems like it's a game of dollars translating into votes.
Well, Thomas Frank, I thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Frank, who's a former opinion columnist for The Wall Street Journal, the founding editor of The Baffler, and a monthly columnist for Harper's. He's the author of The Wrecking Crew, What's the Matter with Kansas, One Market Under God, and his most recent book just out, Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle, and The Unlikely Comeback of the Right. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline written down.